Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum called Proxy Plumbing, a Primer for the Coming Policy Debate. We're very pleased to have several excellent panelists joining us today for this discussion. We'd like to welcome Lawrence Conover, Troy Paredes, Matthew Thornton to this panel today. And we're very thankful to Joanne Madero for moderating this discussion. Joanne is a former managing director at BlackRock. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Near the end of the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Joanne, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So first I want to say I've learned a lot in my career as an asset management, but I do have to say that my views are my own and not of any of my prior or current affiliations. So U.S. securities markets are set up really for trading and for settlement and using intermediaries. And it's very efficient. We have some of the deepest and most liquid markets in the world. And the ability to transact quickly, efficiently, and with assurance means that U.S. companies and companies from all over the world want to list and trade here. The same efficiencies and the use of intermediaries, however, creates challenges for the ability of shareholders to exercise their voting rights. And you see this chart here, which gives you just an idea of some flow questions related to proxy material and voting. There are beneficial owners. These are the owners of the shares. You may remember some of this from law school. And record holders. And most often, these are the intermediaries through which the shares were acquired, say a broker-dealer. And more commonly for retail investors, the investment advisor of a mutual fund or other vehicle where the investment advisor is given discretion to manage the assets and make investment decisions. For example, 401k accounts are most often provide commingled funds as an investment option. The separation of beneficial owner from the record holder adds complexity to the system and frustration for some. So public companies want to be able to interact directly with their shareholders. That is the beneficial owners. The record holders, such as large asset managers, have to vote appropriately. They are fiduciaries. They need a lot of information to do this correctly, and they have to do it in a short time frame. And then direct shareholders or the beneficial owners themselves want to make sure that, in fact, their votes were cast and counted. Most of this activity gets conducted in a compressed time frame known as proxy season because public companies must hold their annual meetings within a specified number of days after their fiscal year end. And most U.S. companies have a fiscal year end of December 31st. Now, the SEC regulates a number of the players and the communications in the proxy ecosystem, but not all, because some of those entities are not engaged in activities that the securities laws reach. So the SEC has looked periodically at proxy plumbing in 2010 and again in 2018, but it's only really made minor changes. And the industry also has continued to work together to coordinate to resolve some issues that have shown up periodically in the voting process. Now, Broadridge, that Larry Conover works for, plays a significant role in the transmittal of proxy materials and other functions in the plumbing. and Larry's going to spend a little time explaining that. Next, Matt Thornton will discuss the process followed by mutual funds and similar institutional investors in managing their responsibilities as record holders to vote the shares held in funds. And additionally, he's going to comment on the challenges that funds have as issuers, as is in effect subject to the proxy rules, the same way a public company is regulated. And last, Troy Paredes he's a former SEC commissioner. We'll comment on the SEC generally, and also some of the issue that seems to have moved front and center recently, which is that of pass-through voting. So, Larry, would you like to kick us off, please?
Yes, absolutely. Good afternoon, and thank you, Edith, and the Federalist Society for the opportunity to be here today to talk about the proxy ecosystem. I believe our audience is aware of the importance of participating in corporate governance, and hopefully I can help outline and clarify how this process works, allowing shareholders to have a say in their investments. And Joanne, thank you as well for the background to tee up this conversation. So I will say, yes, markets are complex, but you know there have been a lot of efficiencies created over the years, primarily due to the trading and settlements that allows even the smallest investors to easily hold securities. While complex, I do believe there's an efficient and accurate system in place for proxy voting and shareholder communications, as has been outlined in previous reviews. There are challenges, but largely processes in place to handle, which is often misunderstood. Hopefully, I can help clear up some of those misconceptions today. Probably don't need to go into a lot of great detail here today, but you know, as outlined, shareholder disclosure and proxy voting is highly regulated. Some of this coming out of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1933. You know, proxy really allows a shareholder to cast their intentions without actually attending a meeting, like back in the old days when you had to bring your stock certificate along just to prove your ownership. There are certainly SEC rules in place for many participants, from the issuer right down to the shareholder. And there's also many FINRA and exchange regulations on brokers, as well as state law that actually guide the overall process. Probably the largest area that I think there's some misunderstanding is around voting entitlement. I may spend a couple minutes here just to outline how voting entitlement is actually established. So your registered stockholders are recorded on the issuer's books and records held by the transfer agent. Pretty straightforward. Most shareholders today, however, utilize the services of a broker-dealer, perform trading, you know, hold their positions, and other asset services functions. You'll see the term beneficial owner often to identify these customers of a broker-dealer. The depository trust company, I think, was pretty central in that slide that was out there. You know, they were formed really in the 1960s and 70s and essentially immobilized physical certificates, allowing for the efficient settlement of trades between broker counterparties. This allows for book entry movement of trades and are accumulated for end-of-day settlement between brokers. The efficiency of this process has allowed for shortened settlement date over the years, you know, back to T3 in 95, went down to two days back in 2017, and just last year to movement of T1. You know, and this has greatly reduced the risk and financial exposure to all parties, importantly, including the stockholder. As a result of this process, the largest stockholder on the books and records of many issuers is DTC, or their more commonly known via their nominee name, CD & Co. However, as a depository, DTC does not hold any ownership rights. And when a proxy meeting is declared, they will issue an omnibus proxy, which essentially assigns voting rights to various broker-dealers holding shares with them. I will say this is just one piece of the puzzle, which can add to the complexity, especially in a global marketplace. You know, brokers will hold securities in other locations, such as custodians that can assist with market activities. There are also other complexities that I won't get into detail with, such as failing trades, your customers purchasing stock on margin, you know, or stock loan, et cetera. So just to give you an example, if you do have a more global security, you may have a lot of your U.S. investors actually held in DTC. You may have a market in Canada, for instance, and there's a depository up there called CDS, or you may hold in some of the larger custodians out there, you know, JP Morgan or Citibank come to mind, you know, large local global custodians that can help with the efficiencies in some of the other markets. However, in all of these instances, additional omnibus proxies are issued by participants to represent these locations and assign voting rights accordingly. All of these omnibus proxies are issued and sent to the tabulator as of the record date. While this sounds complex, this is actually routine daily management of trading and inventory, which is witnessed with the efficiency in trading and settlement, as well as other timely activities for stock ownership, such as the allocation of dividend payments to shareholders. So the tabulator is another important participant in this process. Chosen by the issuer, they can sometimes be the transfer agent or another third party, and they have responsibilities to build an entitlement record for the proxy meeting. This is based on positions on the registered record, as well as all the omnibus proxies issued to brokers and other intermediaries. This record will be the official platform for voting at the meeting. I will say that this is a basic outline for an equity company. There's a somewhat similar process for asset management, you know, more the mutual fund side, but that's typically more around a series of sub-transfer agent positions and or broker omnibus accounts, but largely works in the same manner. In explaining Broadridge's role, we have hundreds of client relationships with banks and brokers. There are other service providers in the industry, and some brokers may handle themselves. A large part of Broadridge's role is to facilitate corporate governance, distribute regulatory communications, and the accurate and efficient processing of votes on behalf of our clients, stockholders, and the issuer community as a whole. Over time, this has developed into a very mature model with lots of technology and governance. To explain this a little bit further, you know, as the audience is probably aware, proxy meetings are initiated by the board of directors, then filed with the regulators for public disclosure. Issuers may manage themselves through the corporate secretary's office or possibly hire a proxy solicitor, who is also another important participant in this process. Broadridge has an issuer services team that will engage with the issuer and the representatives. Working with this team, we can help them prepare for the meeting with any logistics, such as mailing dates, special proposals, quorum, or other voting requirements, as well as any special arrangements, especially with the greater use of virtual shareholder meetings. Historical trends can help, as well as the coordination of material, all in an effort to have an efficient meeting. The first step after this, the issuer needs to know how many sets of material is needed for distribution to their partners and to work with their printer. This is often called a material search request. Through a process I'll define in a little bit, Broadridge works with our broker clients to identify the number of stockholders, their delivery preference, and performs a consolidation to provide an estimate to the issuer. This is an important step as the printer needs to ensure enough copies are printed and available for timely delivery. As you will hear, more and more distributions are electronic in nature. Broadridge also works with the issuer for things like PDFs and URL links and other items for these electronic distributions. One of the efficiencies for issuers and our large client base, physical receipt of packages can be arranged for delivery to a single location and coordinated around the mailing date to help with a quick turnaround. Last year in the 2024 proxy season, the processing of physical material was 1.79 days, which is well below the regulatory requirement of 5 days to have material fully distributed to customers. So on the actual record date for the meeting, working on behalf of our brokerage clients, electronic files transmissions have been developed and are sent to brokers with meeting information. Files are then returned to Broadridge with investor information that allows for the facilitation of proxy materials. The data includes the obvious details, such as name and address and number of shares, but also importantly includes the investor delivery preferences, which can include electronic consent for email, redirection, or other consolidation, as well as householding of accounts as appropriate. While it's a positive consent today, many shareholders prefer to have their material received via email. A growing population of investors also use investment advisors and in many cases give voting authority to these advisors since they manage the investments. We also implore technology for consolidation and householding accounts that will reduce the number of distributions. Just as an example, if my wife and I happen to own the same security, one set of material can be delivered to our house, but it includes two individual voting forms. We also see many investment advisors and other shareholders using voting platforms allowing for electronic interactions. Our platform Proxy Edge allows for advisors to see all of their accounts entitled to vote, easily vote, obviously, and provides a record retention capability. The capture and maintenance and transmission of client preferences is really critical in this process, not only for efficiencies overall, but to deliver the proxy to the shareholder in the manner of their choice, hopefully encouraging them to vote. The consolidation and pre-sorting of material also helps reduce postage costs. Just a couple more statistics based on our 2024 statistics. A record high of 88% of votable positions were processed digitally last season. In comparison to sending full packages out, you know, this was estimated to save issuers and funds about $4.2 billion for the costs. This was all printed and with the postage. So next I'll move on to once the mailing date hits, all communications are distributed. Electronic methods are released generally within 24 hours, followed by the physical mail. Distributions do occur using brokerage templates and logos, referencing that this distribution is occurring for an issuer meeting. Distributing material with branding provides a more familiar distribution since brokers communicate with their clients more frequently for a variety of reasons. This does create a sense of trust from a known source and has been shown to have a greater impact on shareholders actually voting. You know, while this discussion is primarily focused on proxy meetings, similar processes for consolidation electronic delivery are used for other shareholder meetings, such as annual prospectus updates, annual reports or semi-annual reports, and even issuer newsletters, providing for an efficient and cost-effective delivery. So, as also mentioned, vote processing is a critical feature. Without getting into details for the sake of time, brokers' customers are provided with what's called a VIF, which is a voting instruction form, which mirrors the physical proxy card to cast their instructions on each proposal. Broadridge supports the tabulation of these instructions on behalf of their clients, issuing voting results that can start up to 15 days prior to the meeting, right up to the actual meeting date and time. There's also a process called broker discretionary vote that allows for unvoted but properly solicited shares to be cast for quorum purposes. I believe that's going to be discussed a little bit later in our panel. In addition to tabulating any physical VIFs, there are a number of technology methods we have created and support for shareholders to cast their votes, including the proxy vote website. This is the primary method you may see as a link in emails or actually listed in the proxy material. Other methods include a mobile voting app, Proxy Edge, which is typically used by investment advisors, Investor Mailbox, which is a tool that can be embedded in brokers' websites for ease of use, automated voice response calls, and QR codes on documents are examples. Shareholders are assigned a control number, which uniquely identifies their voting position eligibility, which is often embedded in electronic delivery for security and ease of use. Couple more statistics. As you can see, investors have a number of methods at their disposal to vote. And on average, 97% of the shares processed last season was done electronically, which was actually a record. And that includes even if an investor received a physical package. So a interesting statistic, or at least method we have seen, is that there seems to be a slightly greater uptick in voting when a customer gets a physical package. But what's interesting is they will go to their computer and they will vote electronically. Through the use of all this technology and the conscious focus on improving the model, on average, 87% of the shares processed by Broadridge were voted during the season, you know, all which saves issuers and funds from additional solicitation costs. I will add the type of shareholder and engagement does vary. As historically been the case, typically your larger shareholders are more actively engaged and vote more often, while your smaller retail shareholders vote at a lower level, but that has been inching up. Beyond our internal and external audits for accuracy, which we do take seriously, Broadridge also took a leading role in what was termed end-to-end vote confirmation, adding assurance and trust to the U.S. proxy system. Working across the industry, this effort has helped dispel some misunderstandings, creating greater education across the many participants in the process on each other's functions and roles. And with this greater transparency has led to improvements when ensuring that the voting eligibility is captured and that votes were accepted by the tabulators at the meeting. Through our voting platform, shareholders can receive a confirmation that their shares were duly accepted at the meeting. In last year's proxy season, 99.93% of the shares we processed were accepted on a straight-through basis, which was a five-year high. So this certainly reduces the instances of any voting of duly entitled shares and reduced the need for any additional solicitation. One other topic I was asked to just touch base on is the concept of Novo Obo. So this really comes out of the SEC Act of 33 as well. And in its basic form states that an issuer has the ability to know who their stockholders are, called a NOBO, which stands for non-objecting beneficial owner, unless the shareholder objects, which is called an objecting beneficial owner, or OBO. Issuers can ask to receive a NOBO list from brokerage firms at any time that contain the address and number of shares. An often confusing notion that has come up around this is that NOBO is actually the default coding. By rule, new accounts are set up as NOBO. So a shareholder or a customer must give positive consent to actually become an OBO. So I was trying to think back through this. I couldn't find my notes, but this was reviewed a couple of years ago. And if memory serves, I believe over 85% of the beneficial owners were coded NOBO when this was last looked at. I'll also point out that the NOBO list does not grant voting entitlement. And while lists certainly have value to issuers, the proxy and shareholder communication model we just described does provide an efficient and effective process for communicating with shareholders. So finally, I'll just state that Broadridge has an unwavering commitment to ongoing investments in technology innovation, cybersecurity, and world-class service. Cybersecurity is critical to protect our clients' data and customers' personal information with one of the highest levels of industry certification. Robust business continuity and disaster recovery plans exist, and investment in technology innovation for such things as enhancements to our proxy voting applications, the virtual shareholder meeting platform, universal proxy, which has just come in the last couple of years for contests, tailored shareholder reports, and pass-through voting capabilities, as well as a dedication for operational excellence across all participants in the process. Well-informed and engaged investors are foundational to our industry, and Broadridge has a long history of investment over decades to foster continuous improvements in reliability and a greater use of electronic means for on our industry's behalf. So I'll take a breath. I said a lot there. I do hope that that was helpful, and I believe I am turning this over to Matt.
Great. Thank you, Larry and Joanne. Thanks for having me. I think to start, it helps to know a little bit about the structure of mutual funds, ETFs, and closed-end funds, which I'll just call funds throughout. Funds are discrete legal entities regulated primarily by the SEC. At core, though, funds are just pools of investments, including stocks. And as owners of stocks, funds have all related rights, including the right to vote proxies. Funds typically have no employees and are overseen by a board of directors. Funds, you know, essentially rely on all of their service providers to function, most prominently including the fund advisor, which manages the fund portfolio and related functions. A custodian, typically a bank, holds the fund assets. Voting authority technically belongs to the fund board, but the board almost always delegates it to the advisor, as it does with portfolio management generally. The advisor has discretion to vote, but does so in accord with the board approved guidelines and remains subject to board oversight. A single fund may own hundreds or even thousands of individual stocks. And so doing the math, you assume each company, each portfolio company has one annual meeting and say 5 to 10 items per proxy. One fund may be casting thousands of votes each year. And that's just one fund. A large advisor may manage dozens or even hundreds of funds and perhaps thousands of separate accounts. And the client's philosophies and approaches to voting may not be uniform. So I think there's also work to do across accounts and funds too. As was noted, the activity is highly concentrated in the spring. So for large advisors in particular, it's quite a lift. Funds are an important category of investor. I think in the graphic, we were sort of in the southeast, maybe more towards the center. And as was discussed, there are layers between the beneficial owners and the actual companies. In terms of timing, I think it's also useful to note that from the time the owner receives the proxy to the meeting is usually weeks, not months. And the most time consuming thing for funds and advisors is to decide how to vote. Votes typically have to get in a couple of days in advance. And given some of the volumes we discussed that funds and advisors are responsible for, maybe one other player worth mentioning briefly are proxy firms, which again, sort of southeast part of the graphic. They tend to be controversial more for their research and recommendations, and advisors and funds, I think, vary in how much they rely on that. But I think most recognize that administratively, they're quite helpful to fund complexes, which, again, have to cast thousands of votes each year. We talked a little bit about end-to-end vote confirmation. That's something ICI supported, and it does seem like there's been some progress there in the last few years, which has been good to see. you know, just a little bit about other forms of regulation of funds and advisors. Again, both are subject to SEC regulation. The SEC subjects advisors to substantive and disclosure-oriented requirements. Sort of the issue of whether an advisor has the discretion is really a matter of contract. Clients and advisors decide on, you know, what, if anything, the advisor is responsible for. But provided the advisor does take that responsibility, as was noted, their fiduciary, and under an SEC rule, they have to adopt policies and procedures designed to ensure that they're voting in clients' best interest. And that's been in place for about 20 plus years. Funds too are subject to proxy voting requirements. Funds describe in their registration statements their policies and procedures for how they're approaching their votes. And they also publicly file with the SEC how they voted each proxy. They do that on an annual basis. Registered funds are unique in that regard. No other entity has to disclose to the public and file with the SEC how each vote was cast. This is done on Form NPX, and the SEC enhanced that in 2022. The information is now more granular. Funds have to categorize their votes. They have to disclose the number of shares cast, and they have to note if there were any shares out on loan that weren't recalled and voted. And now, you know, so that was mostly sort of funds as investors when they're owning portfolio companies and how they vote. You know, we also thought it would be worth discussing some of the challenges that funds have as issuers, because you could do a somewhat similar chart to what we saw with, you know, the fund kind of at the top. You know, the concerns that operating companies have with the proxy system, I think to most are more familiar, but ICI has done a lot of work detailing the concerns that funds have. Like operating companies, funds prepare proxy materials for their shareholder meetings. And some of the issues we've discussed, you know, the heavy intermediation, you know, some challenges with reaching underlying fund investors, those are present with funds too. I think in some respects, you know, things are even worse for funds. Funds tend to have highly diffuse and highly retail-oriented shareholder bases. As Larry noted, institutional investors are far more likely to vote. Retail participation tends to be, you know, much lower, and that creates real challenges for funds, you know, especially because under the Investment Company Act, many items require a majority vote, which, you know, specifically means in practice a quorum of 50% plus. The challenge typically is getting to quorum. Those who vote tend to be, you know, pretty strongly behind the proposal in front of them, but the real grind is in reaching shareholders, retail shareholders, and convincing them to vote. You know, so a lot of our advocacy has been around that issue in particular, and you know, encouraging the SEC to revisit that 50% quorum requirement. We know of at least three fund proxy campaigns that were actually above 100 million. You know, in the headlines, you tend to hear about, you know, Disney being the most expensive ever, or Procter and Gamble. You know, not so. There are, you know, for a large fund complex, there are instances of higher campaigns. I think what's especially sort of irksome for funds is the fact that they tend not to be controversial items. They're not contested board elections. And so I think that's an area we hope the SEC certainly takes up. And I'll just conclude with some thoughts on pass-through voting. You know, this seems to be something, you know, the fund industry is starting to gradually move towards. I talked about structure at the outset, and again, it's probably worth reiterating. At core, funds are legal entities that own the stocks. They're the beneficial owners. They have the right to vote. For practical reasons, it's usually been the advisor who's handled that task, but it's not, you know, required really. A board could, for instance, sort of keep that function. They could delegate it to another entity, or, you know, approve some other arrangement where shareholders have some say. So I think our legal read is that, you know, it's pretty broad in terms of what a fund could do. And we've seen some experimentation here. I think it's mostly been from the larger index shops. the idea actually works pretty well in the case of separately managed accounts, where perhaps you have an advisor and a very sophisticated client. And let's say that client's a state pension plan or some entity that has, you know, very, you know, well-formed views of how it wants its proxies voted, and that can be communicated pretty clearly. It's a harder challenge in the case of a large retail mutual fund or ETF, which again may have hundreds of thousands of investors. As I said, you are starting to see some experimentation here. It's been mostly pilots, you know, so it hasn't been trillions and trillions of assets that the larger advisors are committing to. I would also say it's not a literal pass through, you know, so if you think of an S&P 500 fund, it's not as if, these fund shareholders are receiving 500 proxies and being asked to weigh in. Rather, I think what you see is more of a voting menu approach where shareholders are asked to make certain high level elections. For instance, it could be always vote with management, always vote in accordance with some proxy advisor's policy, you know, continue to vote with the fund advisor. So I think you tend to see that. That's a little more workable because then those general elections can be applied to the fund's votes in a pro rata way, and that can all roll up. So less costly, easier, but still, I think, in some ways, fairly complicated. And it'll be an interesting thing to watch. I think our policy view is that it should be permitted. We don't think that there's a case to be made for it being required. But I think the larger players that are doing this, I think are sort of moving sensibly just to see what the uptake is, you know, how feasible it is operationally, and we'll see how it plays out. And Troy, I can now turn to you.
Great. Thanks, Matt. And Larry, and I'll share a couple of thoughts on pass-through voting as well. Let me take a step back. I'm going to offer the perspective of having been at the commission during the 2010 concept release, which I think may have been where the diagram that was put up.
Yep, exactly.
Came from, and kind of go from there forward, and in particular talk about the pass-through voting potential. But before that, just to put it into even bigger picture context, so before I had the privilege of being at the commission, I was teaching corporate and securities law, and in teaching both corporate securities law, you talk about the shareholder vote all the time, whether as a matter of corporate law, the things shareholders have the right to vote on, and of course, as a matter of securities law in terms of the proxy process. But as I kind of reflect even on this conversation, listening to Larry and to Matt and taking a look again at a diagram that Joanne had put up, you realize, boy, is that an oversimplification, right? To say shareholders have the right to vote does not in any way capture the complexity that and the importance of what Larry just walked through and what Matt walked through as well. So I'm a little sheepish thinking back on a corporate law and securities regulation, just talking about shareholders' right to vote without really capturing what is an incredibly important process to all of it. And I think what can be overlooked, even in terms of sometimes the lingo that's used, right? We often talk about sometimes the voting process or proxy process, but sometimes it's referred to as proxy plumbing, perhaps affectionately so. But I think that that doesn't fully capture all that this entails. It captures the mechanics piece of it, which is incredibly important. Again, going to what Larry was talking about. But I think there can be instances where it's almost just assumed that everything is going to go smoothly. And that's an assumption one can't simply make. Again, to Larry's point, it's incredibly important to get all this right. And there's a lot of moving pieces. And while votes tend to be accurate, if they're not, that's really consequential, because it goes to the heart of corporate governance, shareholder voting, shareholder franchise, and what have you. So it's really just from that perspective to underscore the importance of everything that Larry was talking about and that Matt was talking about, and the importance of the topic, hence the reason that the SEC has been focused on this for a long time. Because there's the importance of the mechanics, but there's also the importance of it being correct and accurate. Go back to, again, what Larry was saying in terms of the reconciliation and the accuracy of it all, because so much flows from shareholder voting on really, really important matters as a matter of corporate law and the like. So if you go back to the 2010 concept release, I'm not going to go through all that covered. It's a pretty lengthy concept release. But for folks who are interested, I'd say take a look at it. But even if you just take a look at the table of contents, so I'm not going to read you the entirety or read everybody the entirety of the table of contents, but just to highlight some things that I think will dovetail with what both Larry and Matt, as well as Joanne, what you were saying, and again, I'll just be selective and highlighting a few things. So the table of contents highlights topics for the concept release, the current proxy distribution and voting process, types of share ownership and voting rights, registered owner, beneficial owners, the process of soliciting proxies, and that has a bunch of pieces to that, the proxy voting process, the role of third parties in the proxy process, and there are several of them. Then you get to accuracy, transparency, and efficiency, and overvoting and undervoting, and reconciliation and allocation methodologies. You get to vote confirmation. You get to proxy voting by institutional securities lenders and various topics under there. You get to proxy distribution fees. You get to communication and shareholder participation and a bunch of topics under there. You get to the relationship between voting power and economic interests and a variety of topics under there. I don't know. I just kind of rattled off maybe a third of what's in the table of contents. And it just, again, underscores what's been said about the importance of what we're talking about and why this has been something that the SEC has been focused on, not just since the 2010 concept release, but I think that's a bit of a marker in terms of the commission taking all of this up. In the concept release, while it's potentially the case one could get bogged down in the particulars, they're incredibly important, but there are a lot of particulars to broaden out from a policy perspective without turning this into a policy discussion. As such, there's a particular paragraph in the 2010 concept release, which I think really encapsulates the commission's perspective, certainly at that time, succinctly. And what it says in the 2010 concept release, and I'm just going to quote it. It says, "We, the commission, begin this concept release with an overview of the U.S. proxy system. We, again, the commission, then outline some of the concerns that have been raised regarding the accuracy, reliability, transparency, accountability, and integrity of the system, as well as possible regulatory responses. These concerns generally relate to three principal questions," again, quoting the concept release, "whether we, the commission, should take steps to enhance the accuracy, transparency, and efficiency of the voting process, whether are the commission's rules should be revised to improve shareholder communication and encourage greater shareholder participation, and whether voting power is aligned with economic interest, and whether are the commission's disclosure requirements provide investors with sufficient information about this issue." So if you kind of put a broad wrap around what Larry and Matt were talking about going back to 2010, and certainly views can change. There are different commissioners there now than at that time. Technology changes. I'll come back to that point in a minute. I think that's a pretty good, again, encapsulation of what's been top of mind for the commission over the years and why there's been so much focus and attention on this topic. Now, what was made reference to by Matt, and I want to pick up on this to kind of fast forward, is pass-through voting. And as to that, what I think is of note, just to inform folks, is on June 5th, I think it was, so just about a week ago, the Investor Advisory Committee at the SEC. Now, the Investor Advisory Committee of the SEC is not binding on the SEC. It's made up of, you know, experts on a variety of topics. But they're folks from outside the commission, but their input is certainly important to flagging considerations and opportunities and challenges and what have you. So the IAC, the Investor Advisory Committee, held a meeting not long ago, as I mentioned, and one of the panel discussions was pass-through voting. Again, going back to what Matt was saying, in fact, the panel, and I'm just going to quote what it was called, quote, "Engaging with Beneficial Owners, Exploring Pass-Through Voting and Other Means of Reaching the Ultimate Beneficial Owner." So as the agenda for the Investor Advisory Committee described it, and the focus of the panel, and again, I'm going to quote, and this is from the agenda for the IAC meeting. It says, quote, "The right to vote at a shareholder meeting belongs to the registered share owner under state law. In the case of shares of an issuer held by a fund, the voting rights are typically directed by the fund or the fund's manager, not by the fund's investors who benefit from the stock's performance. Recent innovations," my editorialization, technology, "recent innovations have opened pathways for fund asset managers to engage with fund investors, those who beneficially own the fund's investments, in order to gain insight into those investors' voting preferences. Now, as at the start of that meeting, Chairman Atkins made some remarks, as is typically the case for the chairman and oftentimes for other commissioners. And let me quote what Chairman Atkins had to say just again a few days ago on pass-through voting. So this is a quote from Chairman Atkins. At today's meeting, the committee, the Investor Advisory Committee, will discuss the proxy voting process for funds and trends in pass-through voting. The topic of proxy voting, proxy advisors, and shareholder activism is extremely important to me, that's the chairman speaking, because not only does it have profound implications for corporate governance, but in the context of funds, it also implicates the fundamental fiduciary duty that advisors owe clients to act in their best interest. The chairman continued, I, the chairman, must underscore that investment advisors and pension fund managers violate their fiduciary duties if they put their own priorities ahead of their clients when voting proxies. He then made a couple of observations around shareholder proposals. And then Chairman Atkins went on to say, it is an important principle that individual investors should be free to vote their shares however they see fit, and pass-through voting may provide investors with the opportunity to do so. I, the chairman, look forward to hearing about recent developments in this space. So setting aside my view of any of this stuff, what I would do, what I wouldn't do, what I think ought to be done, I think acknowledging that this was one of the items that the Investor Advisory Committee took up, and taking particular note of what Chairman Atkins said in terms of his perspective as it currently is on pass-through voting and some of the underpinning principles and considerations, I think tees up the, perhaps the SEC is going to do something in some form or fashion, who knows what. If nothing else, perhaps just continue to bring attention to pass-through voting. And so then let me end on that point. I think Matt already captured, and there's nothing to really add to it, you know, how it works again at a high level. But what I think is really, from my perspective, important, and it transcends pass-through voting, I think it's a more general point, which is technology has just changed a ton. And on the one hand, that's a simple observation, and I don't mean to suggest otherwise, but I think the importance of it. So if you think about what Larry was saying in terms of all the different elements and aspects and moving parts, you think about the chart, the diagram that was put up at the beginning. You think about the elements of it that Matt added from the perspective of funds, and you think about what are the opportunities for technology to streamline, improve, change, adapt, whatever it happens to be, to create opportunities that perhaps in the past were more difficult to accomplish. I mean, I think that's been one of the big changes in terms of at least enabling the possibility of some form or version of pass-through voting. In concept, pass-through voting, or the idea of how does the vote further reflect, or put it differently, whose voice is reflected in the vote? I mean, that's essentially what pass-through voting is responding to. Even before there was quote-unquote pass-through voting or voting choice, right? Folks talked about, you know, advanced voting instructions or client-directed voting. So this idea of the extent to which anything that's voted on behalf of beneficial owners does or doesn't reflect their voice, their perspective, their wishes, that technology is allowing possibilities to better accomplish that particular end. And I think that's a really important just observation. Again, pass-through voting is emblematic of that, but that might not be the totality of the ways in which technology can impact the proxy process. And finally, to that point, Chairman Clayton in 2018, in announcing the roundtable that the commission was having, so this didn't all just go back to 2010, 2018, here's something that Chairman Clayton said in his remarks. He said, quote, "The use of technology is implicated in all areas of the proxy process. As such, it may be appropriate to consider the following." Again, this is Chairman Clayton. "As technology continues to evolve, whether it, technology, can be used to make the proxy process more efficient and effective for participants." And then he went on to say, "The potential benefits and consequences that could result from further reliance on and changes in technology, for example, whether technology such as blockchain or distributed ledger technology could be used to streamline or create more accountability in the proxy process." So wherever one lands on pass-through voting or other aspects of the proxy process, for me, a general point, as I mentioned before, is the opportunities that technology and ongoing technological advances may afford when it comes to the proxy process strikes me there's a lot of interesting things to explore, which I think is the word that the IAC use. And I think it's really an apt word to explore, to Matt's point, not to prejudge, not to conclude, not to say everything is all benefit with no cost, but to really think about what technology allows by way of possibilities. And in some sense, trying to think about the ways in which technology can be used to kind of meet retail investors where they are, the ways in which they like to engage, the ways in which they like to access information, the ways in which they can access information, et cetera. All of that has changed considerably since 2010, including since as well 2018. So I think there's a lot to continue to think about. And it's an interesting time to be focused on the proxy process.
So if people have questions, if they'd add them to the Q&A, but pending that, and Larry, I don't want to turn this into a commercial for Broadridge, but I have to say that the technology has evolved, right? And Broadridge has been right there. And since we talked a little bit about Proxy Edge, do you want to talk a little bit about how that system works?
Yeah, high level. I'm not sure. Yeah. I can do it full justice, but sure. I mean, in essence, it's an electronic platform. So if an advisor has signed up for the application, they would get all of their customer records sent into the platform. If you have a large investment advisor, let's just use an example. They have 100 customers that they've invested in one particular stock, and they had the voting rights assigned to them from their, from their customers. They would actually see each of those eligibility positions come into the platform, so they can see all 100 accounts that are in there. And then the tool allows for them to vote them in an easy manner, so that, if they're investing in a company, it's probably safe to say that they're probably going to vote mostly in a particular way, where they can vote that, in that manner. So say they want to vote for management or they want to split their vote up, the tool allows them to easily do that. So it gives them prompts to make sure that they're aware of the votes coming up. They can manage their votes that are in there, and it also holds records for retention purposes as well. Especially if they have any ERISA standards or anything else that they need to cover.
And if I'm an individual investor, what's the best way for me to make sure that my voice is heard through that system?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, that's more geared towards investment managers. So I think the important part for customers is making sure that their preferences are out there. And, typically working with a broker, they get lots of communications from their brokers, whether it's statements or tax forms, so they typically have that engagement. But, capturing that preference so that customers can get the proxy in the manner which they want. And hopefully that encourages them to vote. So
the preference, whether electronically or in paper. Okay.
Yes, correct. So, if they do want their investment manager to get that, there's tools in place to do that. If they want to consent to their email address, that can be captured as well. Or if they want the physical mail, that can also happen. There's also other technologies out there. So, some brokers use what's called the investor mailbox, and, you're able to actually have that embedded into the broker website. So it's kind of a portal that's out there for the investor to see that. There's been some work with Broadridge is doing with a Wealth and Focus platform out there as well. As well as there's a mobile application that we've created. It's a mobile app, so you can actually download an app, and if you have that all set up appropriately with your broker, you can actually see those positions in there. So, there are quite a lot of tools out there. In most cases, the material is coming into the person's home in the mailbox, or it's sitting in their inbox that's out there. But there are some other tools out there for investors to get better engaged.
So Matt, ICI has a lot of on its wish list for the new SEC chair, but limiting it just to the proxy process, is there something in particular that as a policy matter or a process matter that the ICI would like to see changed?
Yes. You know, we did submit a letter to Chairman Adkins, as I think a lot of people are doing these days, with wish lists. And under rulemaking, we did include fund proxy reform. So again, here I'm talking about funds when they're conducting their own campaigns. And we really hope this is something the SEC pays some attention to. I think when they did the roundtables back in, you know, circa 2018, they pretty quickly gravitated towards shareholder proposals and proxy advice. And they made do the same this time. I think there's a good chance they'll return to that. But, you know, we really do think there's work to do on the fund side as well. And, you know, just want to highlight some of these changes where, again, I think, you know, I talked about the 40 Act. I do think that's a stumbling block where, you know, the quorum can be so high. I think we've heard, you know, we did work in 2019. Anecdotally, I think some things have gotten worse. You know, when it comes to just mail solicitations or phone calls, people are very leery to engage. You know, I think with phishing scams and all the like, you know, there's just, you know, some skepticism. Why am I being called? Who is emailing me? Can I click on this link? And so I think in some ways that has made things harder. And so I think now is an ideal time to revisit some of these sort of, I think, embedded assumptions that were there, at least for fund proxy campaigns. And we hope they do that.
So Troy, the SEC and any government agency has turnover. So we had 2010, we had 2018, it's now, you know, 8 years later almost. How best does the industry kind of educate the newer staff, you know, who understand the right to vote as what we all learned in law school, but not the process? Is it another roundtable? Is it one-on-ones? What do you think is the best way to reach people?
Yeah, so one of the things from my perspective in terms of, you know, the staff, and yes, you know, folks have left the commission and other agencies, but, you know, there's a ton of folks there who are extraordinarily knowledgeable about all aspects of the federal securities laws, as well as how things work and operate. So I don't think that the commission will be at a deficit, if you will, in terms of understanding the kinds of things that Larry was talking about, Matt's talking about, and what have you, go back to 2010, 2018, and the like. I think what can always be useful from my perspective is the, well, what's changed, right? What's changed? What has developed? What are the innovations, technologically or otherwise, in the marketplace? And then how policymakers, whether at the SEC, I would say this if we were talking about just about any topic, and I would say this as to just about any agencies, not specific to this topic or this agency, and to share those perspectives, right? There are discussions that are very policy-oriented discussions. There are other discussions which are very descriptive. Here's the mechanics, here's the plumbing, here's how it works, here are the practices, here are the processes, here's how it actually operates, whatever the it is. And, you know, the time and effort to engage in the educational aspect of engagement with policymakers can be incredibly useful, because the one thing that you know is that, you know, Larry and Matt and others have a different vantage point and a different set of experiences than folks who are in a particular agency in the government. That's to be expected. That's kind of, in some sense, that's kind of the whole point. And so bridging where those knowledge gaps may be to just make sure that policymakers, regulators, and otherwise have the benefit of the latest and greatest in terms of what is going on out in the marketplace. One, because sometimes there are actually concerns from, I don't know, the past that have been addressed. Other times there may be new concerns that warrant consideration or exploration. And sometimes there's just new opportunities and new ways to think about stuff. One of the things I always come back to is that there are oftentimes choices and decisions that are made as a policy matter, and what that then means in terms of rules, regulations, and the like, where you're doing the best you can, you're optimizing, if you will, as best you can, subject to a set of constraints, whatever those constraints may be. And those constraints may be very much practicalities or impracticalities. One of the things technology does is it often releases, relaxes those constraints. So things that may have been impractical just a few years ago, you know, let alone, you know, 10 years ago, what have you, are no longer so impractical because technology has enabled things that in the past couldn't have been done. That in and of itself, just as a logical matter, can create opportunity to say, well, wait a minute, let's rethink those choices, because those choices were given, you know, X, Y, and Z constraints. Technology has relaxed X, Y, and Z constraints. What does that then mean in terms of the choices we may want to make now, or what we may want to encourage, or at least what we may want to explore? So I think that sort of perspective can be extraordinarily helpful. Policy debates and policy discussions have their time and place, but sometimes it's just making sure that folks have the latest and greatest benefit of what's actually going on in the marketplace, so that they're current in their understanding as then the predicate to making some of the judgments downstream.
Great. Does anybody have any closing remarks? If not, we can finish up here a little early. Larry, anything? No? Okay. So Edie, do you want to do the close?
Yeah, thanks so much, Joanne. On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you very much to Lawrence, Troy, and Matthew for speaking with us today, and Joanne for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.